Welcome to the first episode in our multi-part series on weight loss and weight gain. Most people who lose weight will end up regaining it within the next few years. That's not necessarily surprising because the environments in which we live currently are mismatched with our most basic biology as humans. That mismatch between environment and biology leads to disease and dysfunction. As a practicing physician, I meet patients just about every day who sometimes wonder how they ended up carrying more weight than they wanted to in the first place. But the good news is that we now know many of the lifestyle and environmental factors that drive weight gain. So if you're someone who has struggled with weight, or if you're someone who has recently lost weight and wants to hold on to that success that you've had, the information in this series is going to be highly relevant. So let's take a deep dive into the science of metabolic health, what causes weight gain, how it affects us long term, when it might be bad or potentially beneficial, and what research is telling us about how we might address it. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Nick Sterling. I'm a physician. I'm an MD specializing in emergency medicine. I'm also a PhD with a research background in neurodegeneration and machine learning. One of the greatest aims of being a doctor is to be able to help people to live for as long as they can and in a way that is as healthy as they can. That's why I'm so passionate about metabolic health and the way that it ties in with human performance or the ability to do the things that we want to do. I believe that metabolic dysfunction is one of the greatest health issues of our time. We're going to start by talking about obesity, which is really just the tip of the metabolic iceberg. I like to think about metabolic health as a continuum that ends up affecting how we feel today, our health spans, and the energy that we have to do everyday things. In many cases, obesity is at the end of that continuum, because it's usually, and not always, but usually accompanied by a state in which the cellular machinery that generates fuel for our bodies is broken. In what you might call obesity-associated metabolic dysfunction, our cells lose their ability to flex between different types of fuel, or different ways of making energy from our own internal stores and the food that we eat. And that's why some people with excess weight, they find it hard to get the energy to exercise. There are, of course, exceptions, and we're going to be jumping later into whether it's possible to be metabolically healthy and overweight or obese. Before we start, it's important you know that none of the following is medical advice. You should always obtain the advice and approval of your own doctor before making any health-related decisions or interventions. I'm also not a dietitian, so none of the following is nutritional advice. If you're thinking about changing your diet, you should consult with a dietitian. I want to emphasize that your health is exclusively your responsibility. We're also going to be talking about some sensitive topics, and I just want to say that no matter your shape or size, you should be positive about your body. No matter where you're at in your journey, it's important to be positive about you. I'm going to be talking about fat from a health perspective and through a scientific lens, but people have their own reasons for whether or not they want to change something about themselves or are happy with the way that they are right now. And that is 100% okay. From a public health perspective, obesity has reached epidemic levels, and it really remains one of the most difficult problems in human health today. I'm sure you know someone who has been affected by being overweight or carrying too many pounds, or maybe you are someone who has been struggling with this. To give you an idea of how many more people are affected today than in years past, in 1999 to 2000, the CDC reported that the prevalence of obesity among adults in the U.S. was about 30.5%. Jump forward to a report from 2017 and 2018, that number is about 42. Today, some estimates put that at about 43%. So that's a huge increase, about 30%. It also comes with a really significant price tag, about $147 billion by a recent estimate. Those are the direct healthcare costs rather than all of the healthcare costs. Obesity is an incredibly complex topic, and there are a lot of concepts about this disease that are counterintuitive. So I just want to talk about some of those briefly before we kind of jump into the rest. So the first of those counterintuitive notions is that obesity is in fact highly heritable, meaning that it runs through families, it's transmitted to the next generation. About 40 to 70% of obesity is thought to be heritable or genetic. It's also polygenic, which means that there is more than one gene involved. Many of the genes that we see involved in obesity also have important roles in the CNS, or the central nervous system, and appetite regulation centers within our brain. Also, we find the genes that are associated with insulin playing a major role in the pathogenesis of overweight and obesity as well. We'll get into that. However, in the setting where we have not had much genetic change over the last few decades, we have to start looking for non-genetic potential explanations for the rapid rise that we see. Those could include, but are not limited to, things like what's in our food, what's done to our food, the environment, our lifestyles, and epigenetics. So epigenetics is a field of biology that refers to changes that happen on top of the genome. These are chemical changes that modify the expression of certain genes, and they are oftentimes transmitted to the next generation. And we know that that is in fact the case for conditions like obesity. The second thing about obesity that's kind of counterintuitive is that although obesity is known to affect just about every organ system in the body, it's kind of hard to know exactly where it starts. To give you a preview, though, of some upcoming material in future episodes, I'm really excited to talk about some of the brain changes that even precede some of the external manifestations of obesity. There's also some evidence that liver changes go hand in hand with this disease and may in fact precede it in some cases. So stay tuned for that. The third thing about obesity that's kind of counterintuitive is that the effects of being overweight or obese differ throughout the lifespan, so in early age versus late age, and we'll also get into that as well. So let's take a step back and look at how, as an industrialized world, we've gone from a relatively lean body composition to one where adiposity is more or less the norm. So if we take a step back and go back two centuries ago, look around, we would find that obesity is a disease that was relatively rare and mostly limited to the wealthy class. So in the late 1800s, the average BMI of an adult in the US, give or take, was about 24. Today, the average BMI is about 29.4, with 30 being the cutoff for obesity. So let's review what BMI is so that we kind of have a context of where we're going. So BMI is body mass index, and it refers to a measure of your weight divided by your height squared. So it's trying to adjust for height. So more formally, BMI, or body mass index, equals your weight in kilograms, or more properly, your mass in kilograms divided by your height in meters squared. So we've said that the average BMI in the late 1800s was about 24, give or take. To give you a context, today the average BMI of a pro male soccer player is about 23.2, and that of a pro NBA basketball player is 24.7. So still looking quite lean by today's standards. It wasn't until after the Second Industrial Revolution that the average BMI of adults in the US started to creep up somewhat slowly at first, and then through the 1930s and then into the 1960s, a lot of new tools and technologies were brought into the agricultural space. These included things like chemical fertilizers, controlled water supplies, machine cropping, and these helped a lot to increase the food production in the US and generally in the industrialized world. That was great because it meant that people were less likely to go hungry at that time. Since the mid-1960s or so, the daily supply of calories per person steadily increased until today. And in a similar way, government subsidies that were originally intended to help farmers during hard times ended up changing much of the macronutrient composition of our diets, and in fact, the livestock even that we consume, I think in ways that we're still trying to understand. So what else happened to get us to the place that we're at today? Industrialized food production changed a lot. Whereas once food had been sourced locally and had a limited shelf life, there was now a new interest in making food in a way that could extend out shelf life and enable cheaper transport and cheaper storage. So the whole foods that we once had were replaced by heavily processed versions of those foods, and many of the nutrients as a result of that process were stripped out, and that includes much of the fiber, the vitamins, the minerals, and we ended up with highly processed food being in our grocery stores. There was also an incentive by the food industry to make products of which people would eat more. This is quite easy to do in a laboratory animal model. This was accomplished by adding fats and sugars and salt to foods. These are known to hijack the appetite regulation centers in the part of our brain called the hypothalamus, and that stimulates more intake. So the result of this was that in our grocery stores, we ended up with plenty of hyperpalatable and ultra-processed foods. Now we jump to the 1970s, and this is when another potent driver of food intake was introduced into our food supply, and that was high fructose corn syrup. So to understand what high fructose corn syrup is and what it does, we have to take a step back and look at table sugar. So table sugar is chemically known as sucrose. Sucrose is a 2-carbohydrate molecule, also called a disaccharide, meaning that there's 2 carbohydrates. The first of those carbohydrates is glucose, and the second is fructose. These are joined together by a chemical bond. Glucose is found in our bloodstreams in relatively stable quantities. It serves as a buffer for when the body needs quick access to energy. It's also the preferred source, generally, of energy for the brain, although the brain can run on ketones if it needs to. Fructose, on the other hand, is more of a storage signal for the body. It can be converted and used as energy as well. Plants tend to produce it in their fruit, and that stimulates predators to consume that fruit and then spread the seed across the land. So it kind of serves as a storage signal, and this is especially relevant for animals that are hibernating. So we have this combination of glucose and fructose that are joined together to make sucrose or table sugar. So how does this relate to high fructose corn syrup? Well, high fructose corn syrup is essentially free forms of glucose and fructose with some occasional sucrose mixed in as well. The thing that differentiates high fructose corn syrup from table sugar is that you can modify the ratio of fructose and glucose in high fructose corn syrup. And that's led some to kind of speculate and be concerned that there is the potential for high fructose corn syrup to be sort of a worse version of table sugar, potentially stimulating more caloric intake. So added sugars weren't just limited to solid foods, of course. Sugar and high fructose corn syrup found their way into what is potentially the worst incarnation of sugary foods, and that is sugary drinks. So I'm going to kind of go over very briefly why sugary drinks are so concerning. There are many more reasons than I'm going to go over here, but for the sake of time, I'll just go over the basics here. The first of those reasons is that sugary drinks have what's called a high glycemic index, or GI. Glycemic index is a measure of how fast a food causes your blood sugar to raise up. Glycemic load refers to how much your blood sugar raises up. The concern about this is that having a high blood sugar is generally not a very good thing. It leads to accelerated aging, impaired wound healing, and a host of other metabolic and chronic health conditions. There's also some recent data that suggests that it's not just having a high blood sugar that's concerning, but also the rate at which your blood sugar spikes up also may accelerate aging. And so having a high glycemic index food is going to raise up your blood sugar faster. And for that reason, those types of foods are concerning. The second reason why sugary drinks are so concerning is that they're really hard on your liver. So when you ingest a sugary drink, it goes to your gut and it gets absorbed into what's called the portal vein. The portal vein goes from your gut to your liver. So what ends up happening is that your liver sees this huge bolus of glucose and fructose. And that's very hard on the liver because fructose is a little bit different than the way that glucose is metabolized. To metabolize fructose, we have to spend energy to prepare it for the next metabolic step so that it can be used as fuel for the body. That involves the liver spending a large amount of ATP if the concentration of fructose is high enough. So by ingesting this large concentration of fructose, your liver spends this ATP and it becomes energy depleted. That's very stressful for the liver. There's oxidative stress that occurs and that leads to uric acid production. It also leads to increased synthesis of what are called triacylglycerols, or more commonly known as triglycerides. This leads to ectopic fat deposition, and generally that is not something that you want in any part of your body, much less the liver. In the liver specifically, this can cause inflammation leading to fibrosis and scarring if it goes on for too long. So generally, soft drinks and fruit juices and any kind of sugary beverage, especially those that contain a combination of glucose and fructose, are really concerning for being hard on your liver. The third reason why sugary drinks are so concerning is that there's some recent data that suggests that the glucose and the fructose from these drinks may in fact make it all the way down the GI tract to end up in the colon or the large intestine. We're kind of in the middle of this surge of colorectal cancers that nobody really knows exactly why this is happening right now, but it's very concerning. And one speculation is that our increase in sugary beverages may be contributing at least to this phenomenon. So the concern is that laboratory data suggests that stimulating precancerous lesions with these fuels, glucose and fructose, in fact may induce changes that lead to an even worse and more concerning cell type. And the concern is that in individuals who are ingesting these drinks, if those fuels are making it all the way down to the colon, that this could potentially induce the transformation from a precancerous lesion to one that is more precancerous or potentially even cancerous. The fourth reason why sugary drinks are so concerning is it used to be the teaching that if you had a sugary drink, like let's say you had 200 calories from a soda or a fruit juice drink, that your body would just kind of auto-regulate at that point, that you would decrease your caloric ingestion from foods for the day to account for that extra calories that you had in the drink. We know today, based on randomized controlled trials, that this is likely not the case, that your body doesn't just simply downregulate and offset by reducing total calories ingested. In fact, some people have the opposite concern, that in fact you may actually be stimulated to have additional calories throughout the day. It's been estimated in recent meta-analyses that each serving of a sugary drink was associated with a weight gain of about 0.25 pound in adults per year. So overall, we're just hardwired to seek and store food as energy and fat. And these instincts helped our ancestors to stay alive during times of famine and hardship. But today we're seeing a predictable result of combining that instinct with an energy-dense food environment in which hyperpalatable foods and ultra-processed foods just so happen to be the least expensive foods to buy in the grocery store. A relatively recent study published in the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology in 2016 found that of all packaged foods and beverages purchased by a nationally representative sample of U.S. households in 2013, that 68% by proportion of calories contained caloric sweeteners. So those would be things like sucrose or table sugar and high fructose corn syrup. So just step back and think about that. 68%, and that was in 2013, 68% of the calories in packaged foods in the grocery store are from caloric sweeteners. So we have kind of this buildup where we've been living in what we would call an obesogenic environment for many years now. A 2016 study by the CDC found that 49% of adults in the US had tried to lose weight during some time within that last year. So to me, kind of taking a step back, that seems to indicate that people who are carrying excess weight would, at least given the choice, like to have the autonomy and the ability to be able to decide the composition of their own bodies. But this is really difficult to do in our current environment. It wasn't until about a decade ago that obesity was labeled officially as a disease by the American Medical Association. That was in June 2013. At that time, there was some very strong opposing voices, mostly arguing from the perspective that there are volitional or voluntary behaviors or choices that can lead to this diseased state that we call overweight or obesity. But this leads me to a really what I think is an important point. I want to just point out that there are plenty of conditions where the decisions that we make on a day-to-day basis have a causative relationship with some disease process. Alcohol addiction, we certainly treat as a disease. This can be fatal if it goes untreated. And that involves making a series of choices that leads to a diseased state, and yet nobody that I've ever met, and I've met many, many, has wanted this for themselves. Nobody grows up wanting to be an alcoholic. So I think that it's really important to acknowledge that sometimes the intent that we have for ourselves or the long-term goals and desires that we have for ourselves, they can become disconnected from the choices that we make on a day-to-day basis. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those choices, when we diverge from our long-term goals, represent something that we want. Again, I kind of go back to this idea that people do have their own reasons for whether or not they want to change something about themselves or are happy the way that they are. But recent data on weight loss, that 49% of U.S. adults that have tried to lose weight within a one-year period, kind of suggests to me that many people are looking to be able to control their own body composition. I would add to this that there is evidence in the literature for this idea of food addiction, but I must say that that is my own assessment, and the idea of food addiction or being addicted to something that you need to be able to survive is controversial in the scientific community. We're going to jump into some of the neuroscience of what drives us to make food choices that can be disconnected from our long-term goals in a next episode, probably one or two episodes from now. We know that it's hard enough as adults to have our actions fall perfectly in line with the intent that we have for ourselves. But there's another group who, speaking from a neurodevelopmental standpoint, have an even harder time with this, and that group is kids. In the early 1970s, the percent of kids who were obese aged 2 to 19 was only about 5%. Fast forward to 2018, and that number is now 19% of kids being obese. 16% of kids are overweight. So this is a huge, very concerning problem, because it's not uncommon now to see young adults in their mid-20s or even in their early 20s with type 2 diabetes. Kids are an especially vulnerable population, because by the time kids are really old enough to understand what overweight or obesity is and how it occurs and just the kind of effort that really it takes to reverse it, they've really been thrown into a place where hitting reverse is extremely difficult. Fortunately, there have been some successful efforts to combat this in schools, but right now there are no implementations that have been used at scale that are successful. So we talked about how we went from a relatively lean body composition to one where adiposity is generally the norm in industrialized nations. But now I want to switch gears to talking about how obesity develops in the individual over a person's lifetime. Because I think that understanding how we go from lean to overweight or obese is central to understanding how to reverse that problem. So as we alluded in the beginning, obesity develops over long periods of time, typically over years or decades. The average weight gain for adults in the U.S. during the initial trajectory is only about 1 to 2 pounds per year, so this really sneaks up on people. It's also so slow that, in fact, it makes it really difficult to study in humans from a research perspective. What we do know is that there is a typical arc of weight change throughout a person's lifespan. Much of that initial increase in weight gain that puts a person on a trajectory towards obesity occurs in their 20s and 30s, starting to kind of slow down into the 40s and then really tapering off into their 50s. Later in life, it's not uncommon to see a drop in weight, especially in advanced age or just before a decompensation event at the end of life. This is kind of a med school 101, where unintentional weight loss or weight loss just at the end of life is typically not a great thing. And the thing that is concerning about this arc overall, at least the initial trajectory of that arc, is that we know that weight gain in a person's 20s and 30s is associated with a lot of health problems. What's more concerning is that the initial trajectory on this arc seems to be shifting towards the left or towards an earlier age. So instead of this initial weight gain happening in people's 20s and 30s, we're seeing evidence that is also starting in their teens and sometimes in their childhood. We also know that there does seem to be an annual pattern where a lot of the weight gain occurs. It is true that a critical time period each year for weight gain is around that holiday season, so the last week of November to the first 1 or 2 weeks of January. And during that time, the estimated weight gain is about 0.5 to 2 pounds, so avoiding overdoing it during that part of the year may go a long way. The good thing is that we know that many people are trying to be healthier and to lose weight, as we mentioned, if they need to lose weight. A recent 2020 study published in BMC Medicine found that among 161,000 adults approximately, that increased frequency of weight loss attempts of at least 5 pounds or more was associated with a lower risk of death. And the average follow-up period was about 7 years, so we have about that far to look out. That's pretty good compared to most studies. So in other words, increased frequency of intentionally losing at least 5 pounds of weight in midlife was associated with a lower risk of future death during that study period. They also did find some benefits with regard to risk of cancer and risk of cardiovascular disease. Now, this study did have some important limitations, one of the main ones being that these data were self-reported by the participants, so we have to take that into account. I think actually the bigger issue with any kind of study like this that is correlational or associative in nature is that we have to take into account this phenomenon called healthy user bias. And for this study, if you were going to say that you were concerned that the data were confounded by healthy user bias, it would go something like this. You might say it would be the case that a person who would try to lose weight at multiple points throughout his or her life would be the kind of person that would just be healthier in general and more health conscious, and so they would have a lower risk of death in general. And that's a perfectly valid argument. This is kind of an exploratory study. This needs to be confirmed by randomized controlled trials as well. I do think that it has some strengths, though. They did account for BMI, which kind of actually led them to an opposite conclusion of some past studies that were concerning for an increased risk of death in association with weight loss attempts throughout life. But we can take that study for what it is. There are plenty of randomized controlled trials that have been done, and perhaps we'll see some follow-up data from those at some point. Another issue is that when many people try to lose weight, they often will have success in creating this initial weight drop. The hard part, though, is maintaining that weight loss for even months and especially years at a time. The exact time frame for regain of weight seems to be dependent on the amount of weight lost and the rate at which it was lost. So there's a huge asymmetry in the effort required to lose fat and maintain that new body composition versus putting on fat or gaining weight. That asymmetry is really why I think it's so important to kind of get into the details about what is it that allows a small group of people who have been successful in maintaining their new healthier body compositions to maintain that new healthier body composition throughout time. So we'll get into that in the later episode. The good news is that there are specific systems and attributes that this group of people have and employ in order to be able to sustain that weight loss or maintain that new healthier body composition. So we've gone through a lot of information in this episode. We talked about how we've gotten to a place now where our food supplies and the environments in which we live, in many cases, are mismatched with our biology. And we've talked about how this mismatch can create disease and metabolic dysfunction, and how future generations are also being affected by these changes. In the next couple episodes, we're going to be going into the details about fat metabolism and the physiology of fat. Will go into the pathophysiology about what goes wrong in overweight or obesity. We'll go into what differentiates metabolically healthy obesity from that is metabolically unhealthy obesity. We'll go into how the effects of obesity differ in early life versus late life. We'll talk about some of the food drivers of weight gain, and then most excitingly, we'll talk about some of the brain changes that precede the external manifestations of obesity, and how many of the foods and the environmental signals that we have today can kind of hijack our appetite regulation centers and also disrupt the ability of our fat and our brain to communicate with each other. So thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to support this channel, the very best way to do that is to hit the subscribe button, hit the like button if you like this video. It really is the very best way to help the channel to grow and reach more people. Please also head over to nicksterling.com where you can find the sign up for any announcements that we have. You can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Spotify, and all the major platforms with the ID Sterling MD PhD. Thank you so much again for listening, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or any other healthcare professional services. The content of this podcast is not medical advice and should not be interpreted as medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. You should not attempt to implement any of the topics or concepts discussed on this podcast without the direct approval and supervision of your own physician. This podcast should not take precedence over the information provided to you by your healthcare provider or official public health sources. Listeners should not delay obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have. The use or non-use of the information provided in this podcast or any associated or linked materials is exclusively at the user's own risk. Please visit nicksterling.com for relevant disclosures and full terms of use.